It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Democrats say they hope to finalize a social services and climate change package as soon as this week and create a new tax for billionaires to help pay for it. We'll look at how that could work and whether it will end up in the final bill. First, a new book lays out the causes and potential solutions to public mass shootings in the United States. Mass shootings have gotten more common in recent years. More than half of all public mass shootings since 1966 have been committed since the year 2000. They've also gotten deadlier. 8 of the 20 deadliest mass shootings in modern history were committed in the last 5 years. Then President Barack Obama talked about the trend in 2015 after the Umpqua Community College shooting in Roseburg, Oregon, where 10 people died, including the perpetrator.
Somehow this has become routine. The reporting is routine. My response here at this podium ends up being routine. The conversation in the aftermath of it, we've become numb to this.
Our guests say amid the tragedy, there is some good news. There are a lot of proven strategies that can help prevent future shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guests who have put a lot of time and effort over the years into studying the causes of these public mass shootings, talking to the perpetrators and their families in many cases? Are there solutions you think we are overlooking, not putting enough attention into? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They created the first ever comprehensive database of public mass shootings in the United States, and their new book is called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. Jillian and James, welcome both of you back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
James, in a past conversation, you talked about the different kinds of gun-related violence in the United States, in many cases requiring different solutions. I want to talk about this category you're focusing on, public mass shootings. First of all, can you just tell us about the definition, what that means?
Yeah, so we are using in the book and throughout our research a common definition that's been agreed upon by the FBI and by academic researchers, meaning 4 or more people killed in a public space. That might include a school or a place of worship, a bar or a restaurant, a workplace. And these are also crimes that tend to not have a relationship between the offender and the victims. And what we mean by that is that it's not a domestic homicide. And it's also not a homicide that occurs in the course of usual criminal behavior. So this is not a drug deal gone bad. But this is more a case of when somebody's out on the street really trying to take as many lives as possible in a public shooting.
A key point, Jill, that you've thought about for years before even this research started is it's easy to think of people who do a monstrous thing like this, a public shooting, trying to take as many lives, as James was just saying, as possible, to think of them as monsters. But you say that isn't really a productive way to think about them. Why not?
Right. And before I was an academic, I was an investigator and I worked with people facing the death penalty. And we had this saying, which was the worse the crime, the worse the story. And these are just horrific crimes that it's easy to say that the person who does this must be a monster. But that monster label doesn't get us any closer to actual prevention. When it's just a monster, it feels like there's nothing we can do about it besides practice running and hiding and fighting and give our kids bulletproof backpacks. But the reality is if we can look at what that pathway to violence looks like over time for these individuals and really try to understand that build towards this act throughout their life, that gets us closer to really coming up with more holistic prevention strategies.
James, can you talk about the effort the two of you went to try to learn those stories, talking to, as I mentioned earlier, perpetrators, surviving perpetrators themselves, family members, victims, and others?
Yeah, that's right. So many mass shooters intend their shooting to be their final act. And so that many of them die in the act, or they're killed by law enforcement, or they take their own lives. There's a very small number of those individuals still alive. We wrote to all of them, as many as we possibly could find fitting our definition. And we were surprised to get letters back that people wanted to talk to us. In the end, when we went through that process with the corrections department, because all these individuals are in prison for the rest of their lives, we were able to interview 5 mass shooters in prison. We were also then able to interview some of the people that knew them, family members, friends, and others in the orbit of their lives. What was then incredible about this project is as we started to get a bit more attention for the work that we were doing, people started reaching out to us with stories to tell. So we ended up spending a couple of years flying around the country, meeting with survivors of mass shootings, with family members who'd lost loved ones to these tragedies, first responders, and others who had a story to tell and a perspective on this issue. We really immersed ourselves in their lives to better understand this this phenomena. In addition to building this database, which tracks mass shootings all the way back to 1966, based on a whole host of life history variables. So we really tried to come at this from a, what we would call a mixed methods approach, and look at it from all angles and all perspectives.
And Shil, there's not a magic profile that's going to predict who is going to commit a mass public shooting. That said, you found many common themes in these stories. What stood out to you the most?
Yeah, that's right. There's no kind of checklist we can go through to figure out if someone is going to be a mass shooter. But what we did see is these common pathways. So starting with really significant early childhood trauma, things like sexual abuse, physical abuse, the parental suicide. Then you saw number of mental health concerns over time leading to a real crisis point where the individual often became actively suicidal and their behavior was changing. People were noticing that they were acting different than they normally do. One sister described it as they go from thinking, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, what's wrong with me, to what's wrong with them. And so there's this shift, which comes the kind of hate and anger and who they blame for their misery. And then finally, there's access to weapons, to guns, and to the location that represents their grievance.
We're talking to Jillian Peterson and James Densley, authors of the new book, The Violence Project: How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your questions for our guests at 800-642-1234. James, when it comes to solutions, I think a lot of people have a simple solution: more security in public places, fewer guns, more mental health care, whatever the case may be. It's going to take, it seems like, if I'm reading you two right, a lot of little things, a lot of big things. There's not just one simple solution, right?
Yeah, that's right. And it's about being comfortable with the complexity. And that's difficult because we're always searching for simple solutions to complex problems. And unfortunately, there's nothing there that's that easy. Now, that being said, there is some good news, which is to say that we've spent so much time pitting imperfect solutions off against each other. So we say it's either mental health or it's guns. And we are basically saying, well, can't it be both? And also, can't it be more than that too? So what we've done in the book is really try to organize solutions around things that our society can do, and that might take a bit of an act of Congress and a bit of a heavier lift, but also what institutions can do. So what can schools and workplaces and communities do to change the culture within their organizations to potentially prevent a mass shooting? And then also, what can we do as individuals to prevent a tragedy from occurring? And some of that stuff is really simple, and it's stuff that we can do right here, right now. Things around safe storage of firearms, for instance, which doesn't require any legislation. It's just something that we can all pledge to do and to support one another. And the one cool thing about this, we think, is that in addition to preventing a mass shooting, there's a diffusion of benefits that we could be preventing a suicide or an accidental shooting or a firearm getting into the hands of somebody that shouldn't have it. Or we might just be checking in with a young person who's struggling at that one moment and needs a simple act of kindness to get through the day and realize that life's still worth living and that they don't have to go ahead and perpetrate such a horrendous crime to get the attention they feel like they need. So it's a diffusion of benefits that gets us to think about violence prevention holistically, And that's why we're hopeful, actually, coming out of this research project, that as Barack Obama said at the beginning of your show, it does feel routine, but we don't have to be resigned to that routine. There is something we can do to break the cycle.
We are talking about mass public shootings in the United States with Jillian Peterson and James Densley. Their new book is called The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to be done to prevent these mass public shootings? Our guest created the first ever comprehensive database of these kind of incidents. They talk to survivors, even perpetrators of these shootings. What do you want to know from them? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with criminologists Jillian Peterson and James Densley about their new book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions on the topic. Let's go to your calls now. Chris is with us in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. I want to first say I'm a total anti-gun person, and for many years I've been in arguments with people. So I've been looking for things that might make some sense. And I heard a gentleman decades ago who said, when you come up in front of a judge and they want to charge you with this, that, and the next thing, you can never get out of that gun charge. You have to be brought up on a gun charge. Back when I was a kid, a million years ago, people used to put a comb in their pocket because they didn't want to get caught robbing somebody with a gun. And the other thing is, if people treat guns like cigarettes, you know, people came to your house and smoked in your house, even if you were a non-smoker. Now, hey, you can't smoke in my house. You know, you can't smoke in my restaurant. I'm not going to send my kids to your house because they might get secondhand smoke. Treat guns like cigarettes. And those are my two ideas. And I thank you for letting me say them.
Chris, thanks for the call. Chris, Jillian talking about, in some ways, in that last part, changing our attitude, our cultural thoughts about guns. What do you think?
Yeah, our data would really agree with that. So we found, for example, school shooters, the vast majority of them, they're too young to buy guns. They're students of the school. So they're taking them from family and family members, friends, grandparents. And so if those guns were just stored in a safe way that young people didn't have access, that would have a huge impact. And we also found a number of things that our data supports, things that kind of slow down the gun buying process. So if somebody is in crisis, is suicidal, is a threat to hurt somebody else, what can we do to make it a little bit harder for them to get their hands on guns? Things like universal background checks, things like red flag laws, things like permit to purchase wait times. So our data really supports some of those kind of common sense gun measures that really do have a lot of public support.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We'll go to another Chris in Kenosha now. Chris, hello.
I just wanted to touch up on that a little bit. So currently the government is allowed to have like a database of gun registration information, but it can't be computer searchable, if I'm correct about that. And another thing about that is, if it was computer searchable, then we would be able to enforce, you know, these red flag laws and all of that. And I just wanted that to be brought up.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I understand there's the equivalent of a card catalog for many gun references. James, does the federal government have enough tools to even research things like gun violence?
Yeah, it's a challenge because for a long time, there were restrictions on, for example, the CDC to be able to research gun violence as a public health issue. And that was a barrier to really understanding the phenomena. I think the other piece about this as well is resourcing for the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They have been chronically under sort of resourced over the years. And this has been a barrier for instance, tracking how legal firearms get into the illegal marketplace. So what you might have is, for example, corrupt firearms dealers who are selling to prohibited purchasers, But because of the lack of resources to be able to investigate those cases, they're unable to do so. And what we saw in our research, and we write about in the book, is examples where people shouldn't have been in possession of firearms because they had, for instance, a history of domestic violence or criminal history or other issues. But because of some certain loopholes in the system, they kind of fell through the cracks. And so a lot of this is about enforcing the laws that are on the books, but that takes resources to ensure that that people are doing what they can do to follow through on these issues.
Thanks for that call, Chris. We're talking to James Densley and Jillian Peterson, authors of the new book, The Violence Project, about ways to prevent public mass shootings in the future. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jillian, something that stood out to me reading the book is there's a gap. If you're a teacher worried about a particular student or someone worried about a family member, you're worried that they're going to have some kind of outburst. They've had that proximate cause. They've got that background of trouble. The options are, in many cases, do nothing or call the police. The police don't have a lot of options. They can arrest someone or they can maybe hospitalize someone. Do we need something in the middle there, some kind of a mental health crisis option?
Absolutely. That is certainly what we found. We talked to mothers who would say, I was very worried about my son, but what was I going to do? Call the police on my own son and say, I think he might do something that he hasn't already done. And the police have nothing to do in those situations. So what we do need is we advocate for crisis response teams. So teams in schools and workplaces and community organizations where people can report if they're worried about someone, even anonymously. And that concern is met with intervention that is caring, that is empathetic, that really tries to match that person's needs. So not focused on criminally charging somebody, not focused on excluding them, firing them, suspending them, but really focused on figuring out what this person needs to get through this crisis point and what that long-term follow-up looks like. And we have those resources. We just have to sort of allocate our time and attention a bit differently to really be focused on prevention instead of reaction.
Let's bring on another caller now. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
You know, I was commenting to your screener. It seems that what we've been doing is just kicking the can down the road as far as like the accountability. So we have everyone try to be the same. Then somebody's a bully, and then we don't want to have bullies. And I don't think we should have bullies, but bullies are a necessary evil that you have. It corrects itself when kids are younger. I think what we do is we try to placate, we try to make everyone the same, we try to get everyone through the school system. And because these lessons, we don't let the children learn these lessons when they're 4, 5, 6 years old. That if this is what it manifests itself into. We've got 30 years of anti-bullying and prevention, and I think what it is, you know, here we close out another month of Bully Prevention Month, and what do we have to show for it? We got more school shootings.
Kevin, thanks for the call. James, the approach to an issue like bullying in schools, what do you think?
Yeah, it's we do see that mass shooters have experienced bullying at some time in their lives, but also that in some cases that they were themselves the bullies. And I think really what it speaks to is just where we focus our time and attention within the school building. We've really got to build climates within our school that are conducive to care and compassion and support to eradicate things like bullying. So that they are not, plaguing people's lives and changing their trajectories. And I think in turn, we want to be thinking about, we have spent billions of dollars over the years on a school safety apparatus, which is really built around the kind of run, hide, fight, hardened security type of model. And could we have spent those resources differently on smaller class sizes, more counselors in schools, better crisis intervention protocols within our school communities? Whether that could have nipped in the bud some of the challenges that the caller was talking about and have steered people off of the pathway to violence later in life. And so a lot of it's just around where we put our resources and how do we support our teachers and our school administrators to ensure that they have the resources they need to provide a safe school environment for every child.
Thanks for that call. Kevin, in our last minute or so, Jillian, do you feel like the message you two are sending is being heard by people who are making important decisions about how to spend our resources most effectively to prevent these shootings?
I think it's starting. Here in Minnesota, we saw 2 years ago, the legislature passed $25 million for hardened security and bulletproof doors. And then just this last session, they also passed a new school safety budget, but this time it was about suicide prevention and counselors in schools and crisis intervention teams. So we are starting to see that shift. One of the reasons we wrote this book really for a broad audience was to really try to bring other people with us kind of through this journey that we went on in understanding this phenomenon. And the last chapter of the book is called Hope. It's really about what each of us can do to shift this narrative and really try to prevent this violence from occurring.
We'll leave it there. Jillian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And James, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jillian Peterson is an associate professor of criminology and criminal justice at Hamline University in Minnesota. James Densley is a professor and department chair of criminal justice at Metropolitan State University in St. Paul. They talked to us about their new book, The Violence Project, How to Stop a Mass Shooting Epidemic. By the way, if you or a loved one are struggling with suicidal thoughts, you can find help 24 hours a day at the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number there is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Coming up after the news, we'll take a look at Democrats' plans to impose new taxes on the very wealthiest Americans, part of the effort to pay for infrastructure and social spending packages. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Kringle is Wisconsin's official pastry, but the cream puff gets a lot of hype thanks in large part to the state fair. We'll get to the bottom of a listener question about the real Wisconsin pastry, and you could share your favorite. Now, Democrats are working to secure enough votes for a new tax on the very, very wealthy. Under 1,000 of the richest Americans would see taxes on unrealized earnings, like stocks, for example, before they're sold and the money is actually made. The biggest hit would come to about the top 10 wealthiest Americans. Supporters say it would help pay part of the roughly $2 trillion in new spending on social policy and climate initiatives. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told CNN over the weekend that the tax, as proposed, would actually be a relatively small part of the funding.
We probably will have a wealth tax, but again, it's only 10% of what we need. The other things are more like $800 billion versus $200 billion. But we can use them another time. They don't go away as a source of revenue to pay for how we go forward.
Republicans and some tax experts say the idea could be unconstitutional and that it might have unintended consequences, including for those who aren't very wealthy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Is a new tax in some form on the richest Americans a good idea? Should we be taxing increases in wealth, even if they haven't been converted into actual money? Does it make more sense to raise corporate or individual tax rates instead? Or is raising any taxes on anyone a bad idea? Maybe the spending plan you think ought to be scrapped? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Primo is the Ani and Mark Gabrielian Professor and Professor of Political Science and Business Administration at the University of Rochester. David, welcome back to the show.
Oh, it's great to be back with you.
There's a lot of moving parts here and plans are changing from moment to moment. I want to start out with some of the basics. When we use the phrase a wealth tax, what exactly do we mean by that?
I agree that things are moving by the minute here. And I sort of came on with some trepidation because this new proposal is really a moving target.
Right.
So, you know, when we traditionally have heard the term wealth tax in recent years, it has been a set of proposals by liberals and Democrats that would assess the wealth of taxpayers every year. And for the wealthiest taxpayers, they would essentially pay a tax on their net worth each year. And that's different from what's being proposed in the current budget bill, right, which Nancy Pelosi and others have also called a wealth tax. But that tax is really a tax on what are called unrealized capital gains. So stocks that you haven't sold yet and you've got some gains on them, the government wants to now tax potentially those gains before you've actually sold the stock. But let me go back to the initial idea of the wealth tax. The initial idea of the wealth tax that's been proposed in the past couple of years was, again, we want to make sure that the argument would be we want to make sure the wealthiest Americans are contributing their fair share, would be the argument, to contributing to the tax coffers. And so to do that, because the belief is that the wealthiest taxpayers have the ability to avoid taxation in ways that the average American doesn't, we're going to assess their wealth every year, and that's going to be a lot harder than to avoid taxation.
Yeah, what do you think of the concept in principle? Yeah,
There are serious constitutional issues with that concept. There are serious operational concerns with that concept. But at the very least, I will say, at least you can conceptually understand how it might operate. I have a very different perception of the current proposal that's in the budget negotiations right now, which is to tax unrealized capital gains.
Right.
That proposal, the proposal that's currently being considered, seems like something that was drummed up at the 11th hour to appease the necessary Democrats to get enough support to have it pass the Senate. It is not particularly a well thought out proposal. There are a lot of complexities to it. There will be a lot of complexities to the wealth tax, but it makes more sense, frankly, than this current proposal, which would tax unrealized capital gains. And we can get into some of the details in a minute, but the bottom line is there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly how it would be implemented. And again, as with the wealth tax, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not it's actually constitutional.
Yeah, breaking down how that might work. So I've started this vast high-tech company, and I've had myself paid with a lot of shares in stock as opposed to just money. This unrealized gain tax, if my Robco stocks went up this year, I would be taxed based on how much they went up, even if I didn't go and sell those stocks, which is usually what I'd have to do to get them taxed. Do I have that about right?
That is about right, but let's get into this example a little bit. So the first, you'd have to have earned over $100 million for 3 years in a row, or have over $1 billion in wealth for this tax to apply to you. So the idea is this is going to apply to the richest of the rich.
Right.
So let's suppose you're in that camp.
Robco's doing great.
So
yeah.
Exactly, you know, and the way it would work at that point is that somebody, right, let's say that this is a privately held company. So if you've got stocks out there, then it's pretty easy to estimate your gains. But let's suppose that you're a privately held company, meaning you don't sell your shares on the public exchanges. How do we know that your company went up by that much in value? Who's going to determine what the value of a privately held company is? And, you know, just looking down the game tree, as an economist would say, what's going to happen is the IRS is going to say, well, we think your Robco's done really well, and your company's worth $100 million more this year. And you're going to say, well, no, I'm going to hire some tax accountant, tax lawyers to show you actually, no, this company's only gone up in value by $10 million this year. And so this is just going to spawn, let's say that about 700 taxpayers are subject to this tax, it's going to spawn 700 lawsuits and battles over exactly how much is owed.
Talking
to that's the first problem with this is operationally.
Talking to David Primo with the University of Rochester, looking at the idea of some form of wealth type tax on wealthier Americans and a particular Democratic proposal right now in the ongoing negotiations over infrastructure and human services investment for a tax on unrealized gains. So you were saying that was the first problem, David. The operational one? You mentioned the constitutional problems. Anything else leaping to your mind?
Yeah, we could spend an hour on this. So the next problem that you're going to face is, so now you've got these battles with the IRS and sort of figuring out exactly how we're going to measure the gains of privately held companies. But then you've got a third problem, which is that the government cannot be, you can't believe politicians when they say that, oh, but this is only going to apply to the wealthiest Americans, because this is also what was said about the income tax when it was instituted in the early 1900s. What's going to happen is the government, if this does actually work, so let's say they work out the operational concerns and the constitutional concerns, now all of a sudden you've set a precedent for taxing unrealized capital gains. And you can imagine that all of a sudden the definition of what is wealthy will continue to be ratcheted down until it affects a wide swath of Americans, because this is going to be an irresistible revenue source for elected officials. So why would they need the extra revenue? Because the fact is, as Nancy Pelosi hinted at and what you in the clip that you played at the outset, this is, quote, only going to raise $250 billion dollars over 10 years, I believe, is the estimate. And that is just a drop in the bucket compared with the hundreds of trillions of dollars of debt that the country is going to take on in the next 30 to 40 years. So it may be politically popular to say we're going to tax the wealthy, but the reality is, to actually cover the costs of our long-run obligations with Social Security, with Medicare, put aside the new proposals for spending that are in this budget, just to pay our existing obligations is going to take a massive amount of revenue. And so this could be sort of a way to introduce the idea of saying we're now going to tax investments in an entirely different way, and that's going to change the relationship between Americans and the government with respect to investment, and that could have really negative effects on the U.S. economy.
I want to give a listen to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on CNN here on Sunday.
I wouldn't call that a wealth tax, but it would help get at capital gains, which are an extraordinarily large part of the incomes of the wealthiest individuals. And right now, escape taxation until they're realized.
So big picture, is there something to the argument that these wealthiest Americans would be affected by the current proposal, are getting away with something, that there should be a way to tax them more, or no?
You know, you can make the argument that you know, maybe there should be some sort of minimum contribution you need to make to the U.S. government each year, you know, once you have a certain amount of wealth, right? You could potentially make that argument. And in some sense, that's why you could make the claim about the wealth tax, right, being a way to get at that those concerns about fairness. The issue when you're starting to tax tax capital, unrealized capital gains, is unlike a wealth tax or let's say even a head tax, where we're going to tax everybody in the country who makes, you know, who has a certain amount of wealth, $1 million a year. Right? That's not going to change behavior, because, right, you pay it just by virtue of your existence. But a change in how you tax capital gains will change behavior in ways that are actually problematic for the economy. So it's not as though the money that is in those, that is in some sense inside those stocks that you own, those unrealized gains, that is not money that you necessarily, right, have earned in the sense of income, because that stock could become worthless tomorrow, could drop in value by 20% tomorrow. And so to tax it, right, will create potentially perverse incentives, where you're going to be forced, if you're a small business owner, maybe to have to sell part of your business off or sell shares in your business in order to cover the taxes. And or you're going to be thinking about, well, should I be investing in this endeavor if I think that I'm going to now have to pay a tax hit, so I'm not going to be able to plan for the future in the same way. So it's going to shift how people think about what they're doing when they're investing in stocks for the long run, or investing in their companies in the long run, or being entrepreneurs in the long run. And, you know, even Democrats who are in favor of ensuring that the wealthy pay more in taxes are kind of sort of looking at this with quizzical, they have a quizzical look saying, wait, what exact, why are we creating this convoluted system for taxing the wealthiest Americans? There's got to be a better way to do this. And, you know, if put another way, if you as an American went to a financial planner and said, hey, I've got this great idea for how I'm going to raise raise revenue in the next 10 years. And it had all of these flaws in it, right? It's potentially unconstitutional that you don't actually have a plan for how you're actually going to value companies and so on, that all of it still, all of the details still need to be worked out. The financial planner would say, well, you really need to come back and you know, with a better sense of where you're headed, right? This doesn't make any sense. And that's sort of my perspective on this proposal. Even if you believe, and again, I think this is crucial, even if you believe that we need to have the wealthiest Americans pay more in taxes, it's hard for me to construct a more convoluted way to accomplish that goal.
We're talking about the Democrats' proposed wealth-style tax on billionaires, especially on unrealized gains from stocks and other things, with David Primo from the University of Rochester. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see some kind of tax on the very wealthiest Americans, additional tax, a wealth-based tax, for example? What do you think of this particular plan we've been talking about to say, if your stock values, for example, go up, we're going to tax you on the gains for that, for the wealthiest Americans? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about Democrats' plan to help pay for a roughly $2 trillion spending bill that would cover big social policy and climate initiatives, focusing on one funding mechanism, a plan to create a new tax on the investment incomes of billionaires and certain corporations, hoping to finalize plans this week. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, not a fan of the idea. Here's a listen to what he had to say on the Senate floor yesterday.
They're now proposing to tax money the American people haven't even made yet. Yes, you heard me right. So much for the quaint idea that you had to actually make money first before the IRS could tax it. Now Democrats want to tax money you haven't made yet.
Our guest is David Primo from the University of Rochester. He says, if you want to tax the wealthy more, this probably isn't the way to do it. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Tasha is with us in Madison. Tasha, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I definitely think the comments Senator McConnell made are just absurd. Like, the vast majority of Americans, it's not you, it's not us. He talks about it as if it's like, the vast majority of us are investing. That is not an opportunity most people have in the United States because of vast income inequality. I absolutely agree with taxing wealthy Americans at a higher rate. We've done it in the past, and I think it's necessary given the amount of value they take from workers and from public tax items like highways and roads and infrastructure that they utilize every day for their businesses. I appreciate this conversation, but I also get really frustrated that it isn't the topic of where can we take money from is not brought up. We just approved a $740 billion budget for defense spending, and that was up $25 billion than what the Pentagon asked for. I would like to know why I'm not hearing Speaker Pelosi and Senator Schumer talk about where we can take money out of. When we're spending billions of dollars basically terrorizing the rest of the world, and that money could go to spending on social programs, on housing, on healthcare. We could institute universal healthcare. So I really would like to hear less about how we can raise taxes and more about where we can take money from that we are already spending incredibly irresponsibly and unethically, in my opinion.
Tasha, thanks for the call. David, Tasha with thoughts on both sides of the equation, income and spending. Anywhere you want to take that.
Yes, there's some important sentiments being expressed there. One is the idea that, you know, again, this is the belief, right? The wealthy should pay more in taxes. And I would go back to even many Democrats and liberals in the Senate and the House believe that there are better ways to accomplish that goal, right? So it, here it's not, let's suppose we agree on the ends, increasing taxes on the wealthy. There are better approaches than taxing unrealized capital gains. The means is not really appropriate or unlikely to be as effective. The proposal that was on the table, which was to increase the marginal tax rate on income, as we currently define it, has been sort of put off the table because, again, of opposition from moderate Democrats. On the spending side, the concern there, right, is about defense spending and, you know, whether defense spending is too high. The reality, though, and this is where I think budget discussions get difficult, the reality is that even if you cut the defense budget basically to, you know, in half, right, that's not going to do much of anything to deal with the long run problems that we face with Social Security and Medicare. So what is actually driving our budgetary problems for the next 20 to 30 to 40 years is not defense. It is Social Security, it is Medicare, it is social programs. Now, that's not to say, right, those social programs shouldn't remain in place, they shouldn't remain strong, but it is to say we need to be aware that to deal with, right, the fiscal problems that we face in the national debt, we need to address social programs. Defense is not going to be is not going to cut it, so to speak, right? But that doesn't mean, right, that you might not say that we still should have a cut in defense spending on moral grounds or on ethical grounds. But that's very different from saying that the reason we need to have it is because it's going to help deal with our budget problems. It's not going to make a dent really in the budget problems that the country faces.
Thanks for the call, Tasha. We'll go to Mike now in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi.
Hey, yeah, my question is, I've listened to the conversation so far, and what is your guest solution to solving this problem? As I told your screener that, I mean, Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world, yet he got a child tax credit last year because he didn't have enough, he didn't pay any income taxes. My question is, how do we fix that these people that are multi-billionaires pay some taxes and help the country out?
Mike, thanks for the call. David?
Again, one proposal would be to increase the marginal tax rate that is levied on particularly high incomes. Now, again, you could argue, well, for somebody like Jeff Bezos, maybe he doesn't have any income on the books because his sole source of revenue is from, you know, is from taking loans out on the value of his Amazon stock or something like that. And so that's the problem. But again, that would at least be one way to get a much broader base of tax revenue from a much wider share of Americans. I think the problem is that we're focused on these 700 very wealthy Americans, but all this is, you know, this proposal is only going to raise, quote unquote, again, only $250 billion over 10 years. That's not a big amount of money in a multi-trillion dollar budget. So the reality is that if you're going to raise, if your concern is that the wealthy are not paying their fair share, this isn't going to make a large share of wealthy Americans pay more in taxes. It's only going to affect, again, the very wealthy. And I guess I would make, this might be, you know, this may be just a difference of opinion in terms of the role of entrepreneurs in our society. But I would argue that the contributions that billionaires like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk have made to American society far greater than the wealth that they personally own. So if you think about the changes in the world that we've seen from companies like Amazon, from companies like Tesla, right? Those are because of the entrepreneurial drive of those individuals, and the country is far better off in terms of those companies being in existence, right, than had they not existed. And so the notion that that billionaires have not contributed sufficiently to American society may be missing the fact that the reason that these particular individuals that always get the attention, the reason they are billionaires is because they fundamentally transform the world. Now, again, the listeners may disagree with that perspective, but I just wanted to throw that out there as something to consider.
Thanks for that call. And David, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
That's David Primo, professor of political science and business administration at the University of Rochester. We talked with him about the Democrats' plans for new taxes on billionaires. The move is aimed to help pay for President Biden's social services and climate change package. We focused on at least one current proposal on the table related to taxing unrealized gains on things like stock investments. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, hospital workers in the state have faced violence from patients and families. Find out what's going on and what it could take to make things safer at hospitals. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. It's National Pumpkin Day, so it's time for an update on the Long Island Cheese Pumpkin of Destiny. I mentioned on the show a while back that I got in the last share from my community-supported agriculture farm this massive, dense pumpkin. It's called a Long Island Cheese Pumpkin, or Long Island Cheese Squash. It's short but really wide, and with its pale color, it looks kind of like a big wheel of cheese, hence the name. It's really big. Correction, it was really big. I finally cooked it down this weekend. I cut it into quarters and baked it in a roasting pan during the Packers game. Had to do it in two rounds. The whole thing wouldn't fit in at once. I measured out a bunch of doses of cooked pumpkin in 1 and 2 cup servings for baking, a couple big containers on top of that for soup or whatever. Didn't measure them precisely, but I got somewhere from 18 to 20 cups of pumpkin out of that one guy. If you don't cook a lot, that's a lot of pumpkin. It's all in the freezer. What have I cooked with it so far? Nothing yet, but I'm going to live on it for a while now. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.